life without hope. Now that's living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. It means hope.
Welcome to the Victims and Villains Podcast. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak. Nothing else. I am your host, Captain Nostalgia. And for this one, we are doing just something just a little bit differently. This episode is going to be very similar to the way that we had done Best Friends Volumes 1 and 2 last month. This month, for this episode, we are particularly focusing on the independent film, The Cabin. I have the director with me right now. Please help me in welcoming Mr. Johan Bodell.
Hello, nice to be here.
It's nice to have you, man. So we're going to be doing a review on the flip side of this interview, but tell us a little bit about, for those that may or may not know about this film, tell us a little bit about what it's about.
Well, The Cabin is about a couple that has some issues trying to go to Harry, the character's name, and to his old family cabin and trying to find himself again. But things go wrong, as they usually do in horror films.
Right. And so, like, this film has, it's interestingly layered, because it's like one house, one piece of it is like art house, another part of it kind of feels like it takes influences from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Then you kind of have it kind of takes from like the horror as a whole. But kind of, how did you kind of talk about how you got involved with this production?
Well, I've been working with films since, I started making films when I was like 11 years old. I've been working as like a production coordinator and assistant director on Swedish and Nordic like TV shows and feature films. And I met so many people that on these shows that were always complaining like, oh man, I wish I made a feature film. And they had like all these excuses like, oh, we didn't get the funding, we didn't have the perfect script. And then I came to the point where me and my friend Eric, who's the screenwriter and actor in this one, where we talked about just like, hey, why don't we make a feature film? Isn't it time for us to make a feature film before we're 30? And there we started. And then we set some rules for ourselves, just like, okay, we're not going to wait for anybody. We're not going to wait for the funding, or we're going to not wait for the perfect script. We're just going to have a lot of fun and make a feature film. So that's sort of how this idea was born. And then we were thinking about like, okay, how the hell do we do a feature film with no money and no like company behind us? And then we started looking at like, okay, let's do it in the horror genre, and let's use my family's old farm as a base. So that farm where the film takes place, that's where my family has been lived for like 400 years. And it's my grandfather built the cabin on the other side, and it just works perfectly for a horror film because it just looks really run down. And that's sort of how we got started to have it based there.
Right. So we were talking just briefly before we started recording. There's a, like I said previously, there's an art house feel to this film where there are a lot of like just like really close-up shots of like just exploring this property. As a director, like how crucial were shots like that to this film?
They were really crucial, just to set the mood. I think like a lot of the directing is just like, okay, the balance between like, okay, when do we drive the story forward, and when, how much is the mood of it? And also what is the tone? And I had pretty early on, like, even before we started shooting and I was reading the script, I got some music notes from some music from the composer of the film, Matt. And those no, his composing there really got me to into this mode. Like, okay, this is like how I want it to feel like. I could read the script, I can hear the music, and then I could like feel it in my chest. Like, okay, this is how it's going to be feeling watching this film. And that helped me so much when we were shooting the film to see if the action on the screen corresponded with like my gut feeling to how it was supposed to feel.
With those shots and the marriage between that and some of the music that accompanies in it, it definitely has this lasting appeal that really stays with you visually. It grabs a hold of you because it's a gorgeous film, but when you add that and you mix that with the storyline of Harry and Rose, and then you have this kind of mysterious drifter, and they balance together all really well.
Oh, thank you. And the cinematography, I agree, it's really good, and it's turned out to be so much better than I even ever thought it would be. And I've worked for a couple of years with Charles Doane, who's the cinematographer, and it was his first time in Sweden, and it was the first time in Sweden for all the Americans in the film. And he's a guy from Goleta outside of Santa Barbara in California, and for him to be in the middle of nowhere in Sweden to shoot, he was so amazed with like how the light was balancing, and he didn't have a lot of equipment to work with, not a lot of lighting, not a lot of people to help him out, but he just did some magic there.
Absolutely. And I think that another portion too that I found that was kind of really curious with me is Eric Klammerlin, he's both the antagonist of this film and the writer of this film. And one thing that I noticed, there are shots with him in this kind of mask, and then you have shots with him where he's without a mask. Why was that intentional with throughout the story?
I don't really remember that. It's been a while since we shot this film. But I always like to have, like, it's not a big mystery who the killer is, but I've had a lot of people come up to me afterwards at different screenings and had many different theories on that. Like, I've heard theories that, like, no, he's not the killer. And then I also heard, oh, there's plenty of them. There's at least three of them out there. And people rounding up, like, and I've always been like, oh, dude, okay, tell me more. I want to hear this.
It's always great when someone just analyzes your art.
Yeah, and tried to explain it to me, and I was just like, and I've been amazed with some of the theories because they actually feel pretty logical. But it's basically up to the people who see it and to decide how.
It's awesome. So I think in horror, you kind of have these cornerstone properties that have been established since the existence, where you have like the universal monsters, zombies, and then the slashers. You have your Freddy's, your Jason's, your Michael's. And one of the stories that has always stuck with me as long as I've been a horror fan is just kind of how Michael got his mask and where that kind of came from. And this one, you guys have a really interesting mask that is kind of portrayed with Eric's Sven character within this. Where does the design of this particular mask come from?
Well, it's from Amazon. If you just Google creepy horror mask, you can find it there. And it was pretty convenient because we talked a lot about this, like, okay, what type of mask should he have? Should he have a mask? Should he just be all natural? But then we decided, like, no, okay, let's go with a mask. And we ended up with this mask, and it's been pretty, and we thought about, like, the hardest part with a film like this is always like, okay, what's the villain's main motive gonna be? Why is he doing this? And at one point we were just like, okay, let's try, because we were always pushing up to like the point where we're actually gonna start filming. this was like when writing this, this was like mid-December, mid-January, and we decided to shoot it in August. And then we just had come to a point where we're just like, okay, let's just decide that we're not going to go into any backstory of this character, because we had this whole other plot line developed before where we had like where he came from, more of that, more of like a drama part where he fell in love with Rose. And yeah, it was. But then we just decided, like, okay, if we're going to pull this off to actually get a film together, that actually going to make a film, then we have to decide to keep it simple. Like, do the simple parts really good instead of trying too much.
Awesome. So kind of, I was trying to, like, decipher as I'm watching this, like, what, because the way that the lighting around some of the mask shots, especially when you first kind of see him very early in the film, it looks very creepy, and it looks like this is a guy that is getting ready to make a pretty brutal bloodbath. And then you kind of see a little bit later, as Rose is exploring the cabin, that it almost kind of looks like this could be human flesh. Is that a theory that I'm kind of getting a little bit too much into?
That is human fleshing in the house.
Well, or... the mask itself is like human flesh.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It kind of looks like it.
It kind of looks like it, but I don't think so now. I think that he has a mask. And I have that mask here at my house now, and it's been pretty useful, actually, to have it at home, because it was a couple of nights ago where, like, we have in a living room, we have a window that we have blinds for, and I live in the ground floor, and there was a couple of kids throwing, like, pine cones, like, they were, like, 5 or 6 years old, and they're throwing pine cones on our window. And I looked out and just like, okay, go, went to grab the mask and put it out behind the curtain. And I could just hear them scream and run away. It's pretty useful mask still.
That's amazing. That's amazing. All right. So thank you for just taking some brief time to answer some questions. Where can people find a little bit more about your filmography and maybe what you have coming up and what you've done in the past?
Well, I think the best part would go look at my website, which is johanbodell.com. Or on YouTube, there's tons of stuff there.
All right. Well, on the other side,
I think the best way to keep up with like my next project would be like Instagram. I'm not very good at posting stuff, but that's where it will come up at first.
All right. Well, thank you once again, man. And on the other side of this break, we are going to be giving an in-depth spoiler-filled review of The Cabin with Necroman artist Jason So. So if you guys haven't seen it already, make sure that you guys click the links in the descriptions below and go stream your copy right now. And more importantly, if you guys are watching, listening to this, and you are someone you know struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that take place each and every day. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That's one death every 40 seconds. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. This is the reason why we do the content that we do. You guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope. You guys can find resources like the Suicide Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255. You can text anonymously to 741-741. Get connected with counselors, churches, and more. And with that, we'll be right back. Once again, Johan, thank you for sitting down, man.
Thank you very much.
All right. Welcome back from the break. We are recording live from Studio V, which is our new home studio. We've only had a couple guests here before, but we're happy to welcome yet another one. We're here today doing a review of the indie film The Cabin, who you just heard the director Johan Brodén from, and please help me in welcoming the artist on the Necroman comic, Mr. Jason So.
What's up, guys? Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, are you comfortable right now? Do I need like need to?
No, I'm okay. The microphone's like right in my face. I feel like I'm on it, but I'll be okay, man. I'll be A-okay.
All right. So we're going to come at this from two different standpoints. We talked about this a little bit, kind of in between recording and watching the movie. I guess what would probably be considered like a casual horror fan. Like, I'm not really like this, like, over analytic.
And I'm a freak.
Horror fan.
I am a horror freak.
Yeah, like, I feel like there's two kinds of horror fans. I feel like you kind of have your casuals that enjoy that with all the other genres and movies. And you got just these horror, like, they breathe it in.
I fall into that category. I am, in fact, the latter. I love horror movies. We were talking about my movie collection, and the bulk of it is horror related. It's fantastic.
All right, so we're talking about this movie, The Cabin. Mm-hmm. And this is basically a film that is, you have a boyfriend and a girlfriend, Harry and Rose, that are going to stay the night in Harry's parents' cabin, and they run into some unfortunate circumstances. Mm-hmm. And
a series of unfortunate circumstances.
And so we're going to be jumping in and spoiling this. Before we get into spoiler territory, though, just kind of general thoughts coming out of the movie. What did you think?
I thought the cinematography was freaking amazing. Like, the way they shot it was absolutely beautiful, and the way they set up their shots was amazing as well. The cinematography was really well done. I think the director and him worked well together with establishing their shots and the mood. So that part of the movie was great. My overview, as a true horror fan, would be, I guess there was just a few things I liked and a few things I didn't like. I loved the gag, or the scene where he was, we're allowed to spoil the movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
we've already issued a spoiler warning.
I really loved it. I thought it was great, the gag whenever he was dismembering the body, which might sound whatever, but when they were splitting the blood and stuff like that, I was like, okay, so that started the movie off on a good tone for me, because it showed me that the guy is willing to dismember somebody with a freaking chainsaw.
Yeah, I think the cinematography is fantastic in this, and
it's flawless.
The cinematography is done by Charles Doan. I don't know if I said that name right. Doan, or Charles Doan. And I think a lot of things that I really enjoyed most about this is the cinematography. I loved the overall direction of this, and then I love Matt Donner's score. When it comes to films, for me, I love.
They worked well together. Yeah, they worked really well together.
And kind of like the establishing shots that they had, because I had watched this before you, so like when we got started doing it, you were like explaining to me in like three words, and art house was one of my first feel to it. And you
see that with the first scene,
right?
When they're establishing the tension between the male and female, right? And then the secondary part of the story. So it's almost like two stories running together. The first would be the killer, if you will, and the second would be the tension between the girlfriend and boyfriend. And that's where I first noticed the score coming in. I'm like, wow, they really played that well, because they didn't focus on the dialogue. They focused on the mood and how the people were feeling. You could tell they were like bitching at one another and fighting. And then you had the other part of the story where the killer was basically dismembering that person, and the score sort of melted it all together. It was really well done. The score and the cinematography are really done well.
Matt Donner's like score, kind of with that overlying shots, like it's done really well. Mm-hmm. And like the two of them are married. Like, there's several shots that are throughout the course of this film where you are having Eric Kerman's character. Got some editing to do on this one.
Was that the main protagonist?
Yeah. Okay. So Eric Kamerlan's Sven, who is the antagonist, the killer in this one, kind of his overlay with a lot of like Harry and Rose's stuff, they mix together, and like there are certain shots where it's just very art house, kind of very, but it's very reminiscent of like the way it's shot and like the way that it marries together with the scores, that reminds me a lot of 1974's original vision for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I think also, too, like, there are some overlaying shots in here that where you can kind of see influence from last year's Get Out and even Halloween, and definitely some Scream in here as well. I think that they dug really deep kind of into portray the influences that he had on him to kind of bring and marry these stories together, but do it in a more artistic vision.
I think it was completely artsy in a way, just because of the cinematography and the score that went with it. Man, I don't even know where to start with the story. I like the killer the best, to be honest with you, but that's just me. Sometimes I root for him, you know? I thought his character was, although on the surface it would seem like he wasn't the most elaborate character. I think they could have done a lot more with him. The main two characters, it almost felt like, I don't know, the main protagonist, and I'm not crapping on the guy, but man, in a way, I was hoping the killer would get him just because he just kept messing up. I'm like, man, dude, like, nut up and fight that freaking dude, you know? Like, whatever you got to do, how about arm yourself? Like, get a freaking weapon. Like, I don't know. There was, as a horror fan, there's a few things in there that just made me cringe, you know, a little bit. I was like, oh, that's how they're going to do this, you know? But I was in the beginning, I disliked the girl. I was like, man, what a bitch. Like, she did a really good job, like, acting like a dick. And, like, that tension built. And then she was like, you know what? I think I want to work it out. And he really captured the essence of relationships sometimes in that one. But then towards the end of it, I was hoping she would win or at least survive, you know. So I was a little happy there was a happy ending for her, at least.
So the first kind of thing that... Mm-hmm. You start talking about was Eric Kamerlin, who is not only the writer of this film, but also the main antagonist. He is the killer. He is he's the highlight of this film. I think it's pretty safe to say. Mm-hmm. He is completely uncontrollable, especially in the end where he's just kind of going through the stalls.
That was great. Just the rage of it all. Raging, like, yeah. You could see the psychosis in him in a way. Like, it's almost like he sold the character because the character was just freaking crazy, dude. Like, he was there to kill some people, and he accomplished it. So I like the hammer part because he just didn't care. You know what I mean? Like, he was letting the girl know that he was coming, so he just started banging on that hammer, and I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. And you kind of get, like, little traces of that throughout the course of his film where he's watching, like, a horror movie at some point in this film, it kind of maybe, like, during the first act as it's transitioning into the second act, and he is like, all right, it's time to dismember this body, kind mm-hmm. of like he's like mentally preparing him, like he's psyching himself out yeah. for it.
Puts on the poncho.
Yeah, he puts on the poncho. He's like getting really intimate with his axe.
I was really hoping they weren't gonna like run that mask idea into the ground because it's been so overdone. So I was relieved when they didn't just have a weapon wielding, mask wearing villain running kids down on a peninsula, if you will. So I'm glad they took the mask off. I could have done without the mask, but I get it. I see what it's there for, you know, just to sort of add a little mystery and stuff like that to who is the killer and stuff like that. But I think he did a good job as the main villain.
I love that mask. Like, personally, like, it's, again, I think it just kind of goes to the influences that poured themselves into this. You know, mm-hmm. you look at other mask wielding mm-hmm. genre pieces of, like,
it's the psychology of
exactly
it, yeah, it's like
the duology.
If you can see somebody's eye in their face, it takes some fear out of it. If somebody's wearing a mask and they're trying to like beat you with a stick, it makes you a little bit more fearful. So I mean, I see what it you know, it's a delivery vessel for fear,
especially the way that it's shot. When we first meet mm-hmm. Sven, it's you can't see his eyes, so it makes it like that even more like more creepy. Like you automatically pay attention mm-hmm. to this.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to pull the mask thing off, so I think they balanced it pretty well. I don't think they overdid it,
It wasn't overkill. And, like, I think for the most part, you only see the mask in, like, a handful of shots. You see him when he's dismembering the homeowner.
Well, I get that. Like, you don't really want – I don't think you'd really want, like, globs of blood shooting up your nose when you're cutting somebody's arms off with a chainsaw. I'm sure that'd get a little messy, you know. So I get that part of it all. I do. And I get, you know, like, making people fearful, you know. I get that as well. And I'm just glad they took it off and, you know, showed the real killer.
Yeah, and when they kind of take it off and they kind of get to explore who he is, you really see just kind of how nuts he is. Like, mm-hmm. even when they first get there, the Harry and Rose characters, when they first get there, he's like, you know, they're trying to convince him to just let them go across the lake to his parents' cabin. And when he finally greenlights it, he's looking for the cat, and he's just like, meow.
Yeah.
Woof!
Yeah.
And, like, you just kind of see, like, this, like, weird behavior that slowly starts to pour into the climax mm-hmm. of showing just kind of how unpredictable he really is.
Yeah, the end where he says, I think he says something like, bad things happen for no reason or something, or, you know, things happen for no reason or whatever. I get it. I understood it now. It doesn't seem like it was, like, premeditated, like that dude just killed the other guy and hung out in his house, and it was just by chance that this argumentative couple was going to a family cabin, you know. So he lucked out, essentially. If he wanted more victims, he just got a prime time opportunity for two kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the two arcs, they marry nicely to each other. But I think that there's the Harry and Rose characters, I think, especially the Rose characters, it almost kind of seems like it's just there. Like, you don't really have a lot to be invested in, I feel like. And so those were the kind of characters that I felt like maybe were a little bit of a cinematic misstep.
Do you mean the couple?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I mean, they're there for the setup of
Yeah, it's a story delivery. Yeah. Yeah. My favorite part, though, and I'm just going to say this, so I'm sorry to the boyfriend guy, but that girl was tougher than him, and she had a bigger set of balls than he did, because when the state, listen, she did everything, she almost did everything right, besides being a jerk to the main guy. She was great. First thing she did was grab a knife, which was, you know what, that was smart. What did the other dude do? Nothing. He hid, you know, he didn't arm himself. She armed herself. Even though she fell and dropped the weapon, which we had talked about, that's, you know, for horror movies, that's something that always seems to happen, is somebody's going to fall in a horror movie when they're running, you know, through a scene. But she... You know, even at the end when she, like, killed the guy and gut-shotted him with the pitchfork, you know, after she witnessed her boyfriend getting his head beat in with a shovel, like, she knew what was up. Like, she was a warrior. She, if anybody was going to live, it was going to be her. It certainly wasn't going to be the boyfriend, because as it goes, I swear to God, he did everything wrong. You know what I mean? Like, hey, let's split up. You know what? I'm going to go explore this house of this killer with guts and debris all over the table. But you know what? I'm going to go deeper into the house without any weaponry at all. And then I'm going to look out the window. Come on, man. You freaking deserve to die for that alone. And then not only that, he splits him up twice. So, you know. Yeah, I was secretly, whenever he got his head bashed in, I was like, you freaking deserve that. Sounds bad, I know, but I am a horror fan.
I mean, I kind of went through that same thing with their characters, like, mm-hmm. maybe not to that extent of, like, wanting to see him die.
And you knew it was coming, come on!
I did, but he dies a brutal death.
Uh-huh, yeah, like, that's one of the best gags in there, besides the dismemberment, right? You know, like, the dismemberment was great because they used all this blood and, like, just splatting the crap everywhere. I'm sure the special effects guys were just having a field day, you know. Just,
oh, absolutely.
I would, you know. I would try to get it in the actor's mouth on purpose and stuff, but he was wearing the mask. The shovel scene is one of my favorites because of the splitting. You know, you just knew he was just – that was it. the third hit, you're like, ooh, he's dead. He's not coming back. And then he just kept going, and you're like, ooh. And then I sort of felt like an asshole because I was hoping he would get it, but just not get his face beat in like that with like 12 shots with a shovel. Like, that was a wrap. It was.
But I think that shot too, like, one of the reasons that it's so effective is the harkens back to the cinematography of it and just the way that it's shot. Like, it's shot in this like brutal, almost kind of like first person shot, because it's like it keeps going back and forth between Sven and Rose, and like, you're seeing her reaction to this, which I think really makes it all the much more effective of a death.
Well, I mean, she had to act like she was seeing somebody that she loved get his face beat in with a shovel. So it was brutal, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, all right, so like, you just talked about the kind of the thing that I wanted to direct it, the conversation towards, was the relationship aspect of this, because this is kind of the aspect of the film that kind of really loses me, because we spend 85% of the movie with them arguing at one another, and then they
about
have,
everything. Exactly. About everything.
And so like, for like the first like half of this movie, like, she is
building just herself up to be a bitch.
Right.
Basically.
And so they have this, like, then they're like, oh, she has this, like, change of heart. She's like, I want to give us another
shot. Like that. It was a magic fire. The guy went to build the fire, and she's like, listen, you can't even do that right, basically. And they did that, you know, like, with the music and the, I think that was the second time. Because I'd noticed they used certain tricks in the movie, you know, like how they would tell the story between the killer, the relationship between the killer and the couple, and how they would do that is if they wanted to just push the mood of a story, is they would use the score with certain scenes, right? So how they set that up was, this dude gets all this wood, right, pulls out this 55-gallon drum to make a fire outside. Never mind the romantic fireplace inside. No. Let's just build it in outside. So he builds it.
Well, and that's more romantic.
Right. Besides the fireplace inside, where you could possibly get naked. But so they're making this fire, and the guy can't even light it up, remember? And then she lights it up, and she starts the fire. Mm-hmm. And then it's almost like she's like, this fucking dude, like, I got to make a fire for him. I think, you know what? I love him. I'm going to work this out with him.
But it doesn't make it, like, that scene to me in the scope of things doesn't make any sense, because literally as soon as Sven comes back in the picture, and it's like they're on high alert now, they're facing off against this killer, they go right back to bickering. Like, it's like that one scene has no effect on the overall
plot.
No
merit, yeah. Well, I don't know. The relationship aspect that, for me, the way I'm with you, it lost me a little bit, because I'm like, wait, like, she's really a dickhead to him. Why did he invite her along? Because she really did, like, she just complained the whole time, where it was everything. What'd she say? If this place is a shithole, I'm breaking up with you. And, oh my God, you can't read the map. And she was just constantly hammering this guy, you know. And then all of a sudden they go across this, they go to the peninsula, and she throws a hissy fit where she just can't be there. So she wants to leave immediately after they get there. And this guy's like, yeah, sure. Here's my testicles. Let me row you back over there. Let's get out of here. And then, oh my God, the vehicle got stolen. Okay, here's my other testicle. Let me row you back there. And she's like, you know what? This fire that I lit changed my mind. I think I love you. And you're like, okay, like, is she bipolar? Like, how do you go from... She literally said, I hate you.
Oh, they say it a couple times.
Remember?
Prior to that.
Yeah, and he's like, would you quit bitching? And I was thinking, I was like, man, I don't know. I don't know if I would talk to Caitlin like that. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't... It just seemed like the way they talked to each other. I don't know. I think that was, for me, part of maybe the scripting, where it seemed more like... they were forced to fight, if you will, like, you know, like saying, like calling somebody a bitch or something like that. Or like, you know, I couldn't imagine, I don't know, like maybe different people fight different ways, but the way they were fighting and bickering just seemed fake.
Yeah, I don't know. Like,
forced.
To me, like, that a lot of the, because I feel like when we first meet Harry, like, as much as he kind of embodies all of these horror tropes about what not to do in a horror film.
Every one of them. He's a, categorically, bro. You could check him right off, dude. He hits them all.
I mean, he's a likable character, I feel like. And then you kind of have his likability up against her like dislikability. And by the end, I mean, it eventually switches to where
polarizes.
All of his choices have led to this moment where he is now dead and she is now the victor. She was so polarizing to watch with with the film. And to me, I think that it was just kind of like some of her points were some of the weakest ones. Like, I am thrilled beyond belief with the ending. I think the ending is one of the strongest portions of this film, especially as she's riding off literally into the sunset. I think that it's one of the most poetic aspects of this film, but to get to that point, especially with her, it's really hard because she is such a dislikable character.
It would have only been cooler had there been like more gore when she was murking the killer, you know, like if she would have had like blood on her face or something riding off into the sunset on her motorcycle. But it was cool the way it ended, I'd say. But you really didn't like her in the beginning of the movie, and at the end of it, you're rooting for her. So they did a good job on fooling you, you know, where you wanted to dislike this person because she was just the perpetual complainer about everything. So you're like, man, I don't think I would have brought that chick to the cabin with me.
And that's her first impression too, is the two of them are riding in a car to the cabin. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I like the sound of the noise from the busyness city, yeah. of the city. I like the smell of urine as I'm walking to the subway every call day. And it's like, someone is like very much a princess throughout the course of this. And I mean, she embodies it really well. I think that the actress, Caitlin Crumpet, she did a really good performance with what she was given. I just think that kind of her character and the placement that you have with her character and the character's arc kind of just doesn't really add or take away anything to the film. It's just kind of a lukewarm standstill up until the ending.
Well, she fooled me into believing that she was just a bitch. So the actress did a very good job. Caitlin, is it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Caitlin Crumpet.
Caitlin, yeah, she did a good job convincing me that she was this character. You know, it seemed like she did a good job, but it seemed like the dialogue was almost forced to her. You know, like especially some of the, I don't know, you ever fight with somebody that you cared about, right? Like, so your insults sort of string a little bit different. So it almost seemed like her scenes of fighting and frustration were scripted. I think that actress could have probably taken it home, or who's to say, but.
Yeah, but all right. So when we're first introduced to this film, we are introduced to Thomas, who is a horror loving guy that lives in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Much like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the unfortunate events of Sven.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of how do you think that this film handles its opening and laying its foundation?
The opening was good. I liked it. I think that was, you know, there's the movie's good when it comes to like their gags, you know. And when I say gags, people, I mean in the horror industry, a gag is sort of like a selling point, like a violent selling point, if you will. Just to give you some clarity. I think the beginning scene was pretty moody, and it established it. Established the killer. I liked how it was subtle instead of just gory. You know, they waited to hit you with the gore because, you know, you never want to hit fans off like that. You want to give them a reason to continue watching. If you just, like, explode violence in the first 5 seconds, it won't have as much impact later. So I think they handled the beginning pretty well.
Yeah, I'm going to say the same. I think that the beginning is one of the... It starts off really strong and it ends really strong. Sometimes the journey to get from point A to point B isn't the strongest portion of this. But I think that the way that they open this with him, even the very brief amount of time, because you only get to see this guy for
a little
like
bit, yeah,
two to five minutes.
I think he spends more time getting dismembered than he does acting.
Yeah. So I think that the misdirection of the cat, kind of as, you know, he's going to investigate these weird noises outside.
You had to know that jump scare was coming. Like, didn't you see that? You know, like, as a horror fan, I know I can sense jump scares coming. Just call it my spidey sense, but we'll call it my jump scare sense. I knew that was coming. So as soon as the cat came, I was like, oh, it's game time. You know, like, it's go-go time for the jump scare. And then that's when...
Yeah, and like the way that they shot it with him like kind of like just going up the stairs, and it just, the camera just focuses on him and the mask. Like, it's such a brilliant way to introduce your killer, and then you kind of just go upstairs and he's just going about his normal.
What's up with the organ though? Come on, man. Like, the dude's like, by the way, I don't know if you know this or not, but I play the freaking creepy organ. Right now, it just sounds like a horror movie. I live my life this way.
I mean, look, let's be honest. Like, as a horror fan, if you lived in the middle of nowhere, and
I would totally play an organ. Exactly. I would too. I would try to scare the shit out of my neighbors. I would like open up my window and I'd wait, you know, for like something just creepy to happen, and you'd hear it. It'd be like, burr, burr. Yeah, I would.
I think that organ, it's a more effective tool, and when it's brought together with. It's like faded into his
storyline. The whole, yeah,
well, not his storyline.
Reason for the organ to be there.
Yeah, but when it's established to your transitioning between Thomas's organ playing into Mark Donner's score for the script, it blends so flawlessly.
Well, that's the reason to have the organ, is having the first guy to get killed play the organ.
Yeah, and then there's that a great shot where he goes down. And then he comes back up, and it's just the mask and him, and he's got this like blood splatter across his face from him, and then it just sequence.
Let me ask you a question. Let's move beyond the first scene. Now, remember when, what's the guy's name?
Harry.
Harry,
played by Christopher Lee Page.
I'm horrible with names, so I'm sorry in advance. Harry. When Harry's upstairs, right, and the killer is walking through like the courtyard from the barn or whatever, and he walks by that organ and he pauses a little bit and just looks at it like, man, that's a creepy ass organ. And it started playing just randomly, remember?
Yeah.
Here's my question.
Go for it.
Was the dude in the beginning really playing it, or was he like lip syncing with the organ?
I thought about that watching this. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, is he really?
Well, in reality, the actor was probably, in fact, not playing the organ. But what if in the story he was faking it?
Yeah, I don't know. Like that one scene, it's a little bit harder to kind of go through, because it almost kind of seems like they're establishing this really grounded tone. And then, like, when we were watching it, you were like, oh, it's just started playing on its own, because its sole purpose is for a jump scare, because it goes jump scare, curtain pulls, and then he's like, oh, this mask is here. Like, for me, that
like, it took him that much to put that shit together, like, for real.
Yeah,
too.
Like, it kind of took me out of it a little bit, and I kind of like, I wished that, you know, maybe that scene hadn't been there for that specific purpose. Like,
well, with the pacing of a horror movie, they have to hit you with a jump scare. If you think about it like a mathematical equation, in the horror movie genre, like, you always want to make people like shit themselves in a way, you know, like, you want to grab them, just be like, whoa, what was that? So there are jump scares. You could almost count them down in a way, like, you knew they were coming. So when it came to that organ and it got real quiet and it paused, and then all of a sudden, bam, they hit with that like C flat, you know, and it's just, you knew that jump scare was going to be there. I think so. I don't know. I enjoyed it just because you could almost see it coming, but it was so cliche. And then all of a sudden, I don't know why my mind wandered that way, but when it started playing, I was like, I wonder if that dude that got like knocked out before he got dismembered was just like faking, like, you know, or if he was like supposedly really playing. And then I thought about the character that just got dismembered, like, it mattered, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I'm
gonna say he was faking it.
Probably. I mean, maybe not.
He's like, I'm gonna take it back to old school, back in 1972 when I was playing in church choir.
What if he had like a routine where he was like, in the beginning, like he would watch a horror movie before bed, play a little bit of the organ, brush his teeth, and then just turn.
Oh yeah, like what if the horror movie inspired him and he was pretending that he was scoring that? Yeah, that's way better than what I thought. I thought I was just like bullshitting it and like hitting play and being like, look at me rock, like Milli Vanilli.
Which I think it's so cool that throughout the course of this beat that he's watching a horror film. And it even there's even like a harkens back to the – so let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's a moment where Sven's character, right before he dismembers Thomas, mm-hmm. where he is watching the same movie that Thomas was watching prior to the organ playing. Do you think he was trying to get into the character's, like, his victim's head of how he lives?
Maybe. I mean, ultimately, he's killing him, so maybe he wanted to know something about him before he chopped him up with the chainsaw. Who's to say?
Does that make him a little bit more sadistic and more effective as a killer?
I think the killer is just crazy. I mean, that's like, so it could, it's open season for the killer. The killer was crazy. So, yeah, it would make sense, you know? Like, what? Hey, you know what? Check this out, buddy. I'm going to chop you up and put you in the bags, but I'm going to see what you were watching first. What did you have for dinner, too? I
want to know all about you. I want to know how you slept, how you snored.
Wow, that'd be creepy.
Like, it makes it a little bit more effective as a killer that it's not just some guy that is just killing people. Like, I think that the fact that he's kind of getting to know his victims, if that is the case, it makes him posthumously, it makes him a little bit more effective
as a killer.
Yes.
Well, yeah, psychologically
a little bit creepier too.
A lot creepier, you know. Like, if you take the time to get to know somebody, you then have to sever that tie and you're gonna kill him anyway. So conventionally you would think that the killer wouldn't want to get to know their victims like that, but who's to say? It'd be a whole lot cooler if he did. You know? Yeah, a whole lot cooler if he did.
I would have loved to kind of see a little bit more. I feel like the Sven, the character of...
Oh, they should have spent a lot more. Yeah, man, they should have given him a lot more time and dug into that psychology of it all, you know? Because I could have done without the bullshit arguing, you know? Like, had they trimmed the fat on that and... given Sven more time and develop that character, like it would have, like you said, it would have been so cool for him to, you know, maybe look through like his family pictures or something like that and like really get to know his victim, because they're in an isolated town.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple scenes where they do explore the victim of Thomas's his house and like his family photos, but you're watching, like, those scenes are when you're watching it through them trying to find the keys to this vehicle.
Yeah, and they're showing like beautiful pan shots of like family photos. Like, it would have been a whole lot cooler had the killer Sven like really dug into that. And
I think that I think we don't get enough. Do you feel like that's kind of something we don't get enough in horror, is kind of like understanding the psychology of these killers?
It'd be really cool if they did, you know, instead of just that, because not explaining Sven, you just see him. I don't know about you, but I saw him as a psychopath. Like, my interpretation was he, for whatever reason, was in that isolated town that is essentially 80 miles away from the nearest bus, right?
That's what they established.
So that's an extremely isolated town. So the question remains is, like, where did the killer come from? Was the killer there? Like, there's just so many questions in there. As to what was going on, was it completely random? You just don't know, you know.
How do you even find something like that? I don't know. 80 miles away, like, do you just like get off a bus and be like, I'm just gonna like start trekking this direction?
That's right. And then when I get there, what I'm gonna do is I'm just gonna make some noise out in some dude's barn, and when he comes out, I'm gonna blast him with a hatchet. My next question is this: when he was stalking those kids, why the hell did he have a log when he already had a hatchet?
I think maybe he left it. There's one of two things. He either left it in the boat, or he forgot it. And he was like, you know, they probably got like knives or something over there, because, you know, he says it's Harry's parents' place. You know, they're probably they probably established it over there that, you know.
And he grabbed a log.
Which, I mean, to me, like, it's not really that big of a complaint,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like if he, what we've known of him throughout the character's development up to that point in the film is that this guy is just nuts.
Yeah, he was never using the same weapon.
Yeah.
It was a chainsaw. Or no, it was a hatchet, a chainsaw.
Hammer.
Log.
Log.
Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, we're not missing the saw. But he had a saw. But anyway, so he didn't use anything traditional.
But yeah, I feel like maybe he used a log simply to, because he was just going to knock him out and then take him back and torture him.
So did they take a nap in the woods or what, man? That's what I'm wondering. Like, remember when I said that? I was watching the movie. I'm like, did they freaking nap? Like, tell me they didn't nap. I swear to God, like, was your adrenaline dumped so much? Or like, guess what, Stacey? Or what was her name in the movie?
Rose.
Guess what, Rose? I'm going to take a nap.
Yeah, because, like, there is a point where...
Never mind, we have a killer on our ass. No. Time to sleepy. How about you? Can I spoon? You want to be a big spoon or a little spoon?
There's a point in the movie where Harry and Rose are being hunted by Sven throughout the woods, and they hide under this hill in this mm-hmm. these
behind
roots of
a
these
tree.
Trees.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do it brilliantly
with the lighting. Yeah, the lighting's great. And so, and the shot is great, and the smoke in there is like, the shot is amazing.
Oh yeah, and then like the shot just kind of like pans out to black screen, and mm-hmm. when we find them, they're like,
they're coming too. So did they freaking nap? Director, did they nap? I just want to know. Just send Josh an email. Let me know somehow, because, man, I would not nap. And let me ask another question. Why didn't they stand their ground? Your numbers are 2-on-1. You're fighting a dude with a log. Maybe you didn't know he had another weapon, but you know what? You pick up a stick too, and now you've just increased your chance of survival. I was really hoping at that moment, like, they would just have like a stick fight with this dude. You know, I'm like, okay, well, they're sort of like cornered. They got a great setup with the shot. Like, why don't they just have like a stick lightsaber match or something and just beat the crap out of each other? That would have been cool too. But instead, it's like, I think they took a nap.
But I hearken back to the point where Harry says, you know, we don't know how much are out there. They didn't.
How many? You're right.
Because
you're right.
Look, they basically go from home evasion, let's get out of here. They never once look back until they see that it's only
That one was guy. Probably the second part where the effects guys were like, sweet, dude, we get to break all the windows today. Not one or two. No, sir. We're breaking 9.
Yeah.
And then what do? They run right towards one of the windows that isn't broken. I would have bounced right out. I mean, they already opened one up for you, essentially, with a rock. Like, skizzert, I'm gone. But I get it. They ran to the opposite side of the house to get away from the what they perceived as multiple people, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think that there are aspects of kind of their journey from being this couple on the rocks to kind of, like, being the hunted. Like, their journey, like, it's...
They were a couple in the boulders. I mean, they were burka, 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 burka. You're like, man. Let me just point something out.
Uh-huh. Go for it.
You can't have... Maybe this sold me off on the female, where I was like, man, she's... That's whatever. But she was just beating the crap out of him. You notice that? She was like, beat him up, beat him up, beat him up. And he'd be like, knock it off. And like the one time he like tapped her on the arm when they were driving before they got lost. And she's like, oh, does that make you feel like a bigger man? Okay, we'll let that one go. But then they're in the cabin and she just starts beating on this dude for like 3 minutes, right? Just really just complaining and beating on him and just being an aggressive person. And he's like, I've had enough. And he pushes her, and then she freaks out about him pushing her. And then that's when they go into the score and like where it breaks down the tension, you know, where it was. So it just seemed like that was a little forced. You shouldn't be the aggressor and then try to play the victim. But I get it. You know, like they played victimscaping really well. So the writer did a great job on that. We were like, man, that chick is a real dickhead. You know, like at first I was like, I hope she's the first one to get it. Because anytime I watch a horror movie, I play this little game with myself, and I call it, who's the first to get it? Right? Like, who's the first one? And I do like a mental gambling. I'm like, I bet you it's like that person with this, you know, like Clue, you know, Colonel Mustard in the library. But I thought it was, for a second, I thought it was going to be her, but then I was like, no way. She's way too bitchy and tough. She'll probably survive this whole thing. And essentially, I was right, you know.
I think that, again, I think it goes to the writing of this film is that she's an intolerable character.
Mm-hmm.
But you really root for her in those last 10, 15 minutes. Like, you can't help but. And especially that exchange between her and Sven where she's essentially fallen into this, like, hay bale pit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just explaining about, you know, how life.
What that essentially is for, to drop hay into the lower part of a barn. So then you open that door where he opened the barn, and then that's how you feed your animals. So the pitchfork's there because when sense. You. Yeah, it is. So the dynamics of a barn, if she falls in that and there's no handle on it, she's screwed. She's stuck in there, you know? So I think that whole dynamic was great. I don't know. I thought whenever he opened the door up, I was almost yelling at the screen. Was I yelling at the screen for her to kick it into his face?
Oh, yes.
I was like, kick that open. I hope she, you know what, drop kick the door. And then instead of that, they're like, pow. And they blasted him with what is that?
Pitchfork.
Pitchfork, thank you. They blasted him with the pitchfork. I would have just kept stabbing him. And I thought they could have done a really great job on the gag. Like, it was cool. I mean, come on, blood capsule in the mouth. That's cool. It signifies that he got a gut shot, which is probably, it's got to be one of the most, not as far as, like, the cinema says, but in actuality, if you were going to get, like, stabbed someplace with a pitchfork, the last place you want to get stabbed is the guts.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I just thought they could have really, like, really just made that disgusting, you know? If you were going to do a gag, like, get it.
I think it kind of almost keeps consistent with the tone that they had kind of set up within the beginning where Sven kills Thomas, and then you kind of have that reverse to where Rose kills Sven.
Mm-hmm.
This very minimum bloodshed, but it's very effective in its delivery. And I think that whole exchange, going back a little bit before the murder, the exchange between what Sven says to Rose about, you know, being, that's what life is full of, you know, you take the good with the bad. And
that's the best part. It pulls it all together for you.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That's like almost the mind of a psychotic person, you know, like it sells it right there. Like, now you understand. I don't need to know anything else about that guy. You know what I mean? Like, he sold it for me right there.
And I love that, like, it's kind of, that's where the turning point where I feel like you start to really root for her as a character, because you're just like, this guy's completely insane.
Who's the director again? And the writer?
Director on this is Johan Bodell, who you guys heard at the beginning of this.
Johan Bodell should absolutely bring back Sven, because essentially a gut shot is completely a survivable injury. It'd be great for him to revisit Sven and just go absolutely shitballs ballistic with this shitballs ballistic character, you know, like really dig into the mind of the character, because it's almost like the foundation is there. You know, it'd be really cool if Sven survived his gut shot. Maybe the chick dropped her passport or whatever and he tracks her down. I don't know. I'm just throwing ideas. But he could really do something with the character, because it's not like you showed Sven getting his head beat in with a shovel. No, he just got two gut shots of a pitchfork, which is absolutely a livable thing, you know?
If you healed in time.
You got like 3 days before that poop sleeps into your gut. So,
but think about it, man.
He is 80 miles away.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's isolated. Like, he's like,
listen,
doomed.
He hid the car.
That's very true.
And then he got in it and drove himself to the hospital. Boom. There's the cabin too.
That's very true.
Maybe she's moved on with her family and he hunts her down. That would be great. But really show the psychosis of Sven. You know, I think that's to me, the cabin was just whatever, you know. They were, the cabin wasn't the selling point for me. It was the killer that was the selling point for me. So it could have actually, the movie could have been called Sven, and I'd be like, okay, you know?
I'd watch this again.
Yeah.
All right, so on a scale 1 to 5, what would you give The Cabin?
1 to 5?
1 to 5.
It's really, it's usually it's 1 to 10, dude.
Oh, we do 1 to 5 on Victims and Villains here.
Okay, now I know. A 1 to 5. I would hit it in the middle. I would probably hit it in the middle to lower side. I'd give it a minus or a 3 or a very high 2. Does that make sense? So out of 5 stars, I would probably give it 3. You know what? I would give it 3 sheerly for the sheer fact of the cinematography and the score. Those will give me that'll give it its 3 points, along with the gory first gag. That'll get it for me. The other 2 stars, it lost it because of the, I think it was the relationship story. You know what I mean? Like, it lost me on that because it just seems so contrived and fake, man. Like,
let me ask you this before I give mine. Like, when I first watched this, it up until the point where you kind of like they kind of give this like exchange between the two of them that they're actually like dating.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly thought they were brother and sister.
Okay, yeah.
Like the chemistry, yeah. If they're brother and sister, it's stronger.
Seemed right, yeah.
Yeah.
Not but like they were like a couple.
As a relationship, it just like there's not Dude, a lot
that
of chemistry
story would have
there.
Been so much. You're right. It seemed more like a brother and sister, and I think they really could have made the story like so much more had they been brother and sister instead of a couple, you know. But I think they needed the dynamic of hating one another than loving one another, that dichotomy and like that give and the take. But man, that would have been a great idea.
Yeah, so I'm actually
too late.
Yeah, just a little bit
too late.
I'm gonna go with also with a 3. I think that this, it has a strong plot, strong killer, strong cinematography, and excellent out of this world, beautiful score. But I think that, again, I think the weakest points for this film are the relationships that it spends up
between the boyfriend and girlfriend.
Exactly.
Yeah, like that freaking murders the movie. Like, I could have done without the relationship, and honestly, I think the movie would have been a 4 out of 5 stars, you know what I mean? But the relationship just fell flat for me.
Yeah, and I think that had they been brother and sister, to where they're you know, maybe their parents recently
that would
deceased,
be exactly that would be genius. You know,
coming
like,
back to spend one last weekend
before they sell it at this cabin where they spent all this time, and surprise, some crazy dude, whatever, is there.
Yeah, and I think that it would be a little bit more effective. I think that it would kind of go against horror tropes, because we have a lot of horror films that really embrace the whole romantic relationships, but not the bloodline relationship,
right?
So, but I mean, again, the cinematography, I think that this is it's a beautiful film to look at.
Oh, yeah.
Scored beautifully.
Oh, yeah.
And I really am in love with Sven as a character. I think that kind of a lot of his screen time is just very well spent digging into this character. Mm-hmm. But I think that it loses some of its steam, especially in this relationship that is kind of like, it's really rocky, then they have this patch up moment, then it's really rocky again, then he's dead and then she's not. Like, it just it kind of feels a bit misguided in its handle of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, a lot of horror tropes is the whole love thing. It seems like anytime, you know, like couples are involved, there's going to be some sort of killer coming at you. You know, that's the writing fundamentals of some horror movies. You know, I think now that you mentioned it about the brother and sister, that's exactly what it seemed like. It seemed, you know, like, and I get it. She was like, you know, I hate you, but I like being around you. You know, that's like putting somebody in the friend zone, you know. you're dating, and I don't want to like date you, but I don't want to like not be around you. One, that's like codependent. So for me, it's like her whole character was just like bipolar, you know. Like, she hated the living dog shit out of this guy, and then all of a sudden she loves him, you know. I don't know. It was, the relationship is just crap to the movie. The movie's good. The killer, man, they really could have done. Because there's a few things where he just looks like a psychopath. Like, either, there's a few ways we could look at this. The director, who's the writer, right? And also Sven. So he's, yeah, you know, he's a man of many hats. He plays a psychopath pretty well. Like, you can almost see the crazy in his eyes. So, you know, where did he dig into to find that, you know? And when he was writing the piece, did he write it like that, you know, knowing that he would have to deliver himself on some psychopath, you know? Because there was, like, some crazy shit going on in his eyes. I like how they captured that with the with the cinematography and the score. Like, they did well on that.
Yeah, there's these brief shots where she, in the climax, she gets into the boat to roll across to go find Harry.
Yeah.
And he runs around the peninsula. And there's just these, like, close-ups of him.
Yeah.
Pacing and jogging.
That
and just,
rage. That rage. It made me laugh, so though. Brilliant. Like, the high-speed escape in the rowboat where she's, like, he's just sitting there looking at her and she's rowing away at, like, 1 mile per hour. And I'm like, dude, like, jump in there and tip that freaking boat. Like, get that girl if you want to kill her, you know? Like, instead he's like, no, I'm going to sprint around the peninsula and just murk them. But
I'm totally okay with that because it created beautiful shots.
It was good tension because you knew while they were looking for the keys for the motorcycle and Sven was rolling around, you knew, you know, those two were going to come together. That was going to come to a head where their time was going to run out and they were going to have to confront Sven. The only part I didn't understand is, like, when, you know, they got the keys and they're like, okay, let's go. Like, she left him behind, you know, like, no man left behind. She's like, I'm out. And she's running. Dude's got, like, a whatever hurt leg from jumping out of the second story. But she's gone. And then that gives our killer ample time to just run up and be like, blah, right in the face. You know? I don't know. If it was you and me and some killer was coming at you, Josh, I would totally stand and deliver. Like, it's time to die if that's the way it's going to be. But she was like, I'm freaking out. Oh, my God. I just watched him beat the face of my boyfriend and that I hated, but now I love. But I'm going to run and hide in the barn. You know, like, I get it. It was the vehicle to get it there. But I don't know.
So there's this. All right. So we're moving on the roads to hope. This is the point of our show where we engage with our guest of the week and pulling out a theme of either mental health or suicide prevention from the source material of the episode. And there is one of the scenes in this is where she basically looks at him and it's kind of after this, like, we've talked about this scene a lot already where she basically is like, I love you. Or, I like you. I like being around you, but I don't love you. Mm-hmm. And she throws this line in there. She says, just trying to be honest. And I think that when you're dealing with depression or you're dealing with addiction or self-harm, one of the easiest things to do is to bottle that up and put up this, like, facade and this, like, just fake face, basically.
People like that, we live that lie, right?
You know,
like, when you struggle with addiction, at least when I struggle with addiction, I live that lie. So, yeah, it's absolutely reasonable.
But I think that, you know, if you want to see breakthrough from that lifestyle, it comes at being honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes about opening up and having those conversations as uncomfortable as they are. I had one of those this past Sunday with a buddy of mine. Like, I've said it on here a few times that every now and then, like, I have really bad addiction to sex, and every now and again that flares up, you know, and
you wouldn't just call that getting horny, dude? I mean,
no, mine, I'm talking specifically about, like, pornography.
Okay, if you filmed your own porn, would it make it okay then? I'm just asking a hypothetical question. Okay. I'm just
not for me. Like, at least, like, the where I stand, convictually speaking, like, to me, it's a part of my life that, like, I just don't want to have in my life anymore.
Okay.
And, you know, it's telling someone else about that, it was breakthrough. And I think that that's the first step is, you know, when you go through something like Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, they say, you know, the first step in having to be there is
admitting you have a problem.
Admitting you have
a problem. Absolutely.
And this past episode that we just released on A Star Is Born, there's a...
Oh, I just saw that. That's
fantastic movie.
It blew my mind. Like, my girlfriend cried like 3 times. I almost cried. And at the end, I was like, I'm going to move that. Because at the end, it got me. Mm-hmm. I didn't cry. Not that I would give a shit if I did. I mean, you know. But what got me was I thought the setup was coming where Bradley Cooper was going to die on a motorcycle. Okay? But then now let me tell you why. Because it was like he was all messed up on the pills. And I knew, like, as a storyteller myself, I can see certain things coming at me when a story is involved, a movie is involved. I know the delivery mechanisms that we use to tell a story because I tell the stories myself. So it's like it led you up to believe that he might die on the motorcycle. That's why they were showing the motorcycle and they put it in a few shots. You know, it's like Bradley Cooper did an amazing job with this because did you see him killing himself coming on? Did the scene when he was in rehab and talking to his friend saying that he was upset about trying to hang it up or do the deed, as he said, and the ceiling fan fell on his head after he kills himself. I saw that foreshadowing, but I didn't see it at the time. I thought he was just bullshitting with the guy. You know what I mean? So it really blew my mind, but that's depression. So it blew when I'm talking to Caitlin. Okay. So my girlfriend and I watch this and I'm like, what the fuck? So when he had his belt, I'm like, oh no. Like, I knew what was going on immediately. At first when he parked his truck and it did the pan shot to his motorcycle, I'm like, oh, he's going to get on his motorcycle and wreck his motorcycle. And that's how they're going to deliver his death, because they needed to deliver the death to make sure that the star was born. Okay. That's how that works. Like, the true star was born after that with the story. But I thought they were going to get him that way. I didn't see suicide coming at all, and he did a great job, because that's the way that shit works. Is sometimes you just don't see it coming. You know, the people that you love, you don't see it coming. Once I saw the belt, like, it hit me in the gut. I'm like, oh no. And then he put his hat down, and I'm like, shit. And then before he shut the garage door, I was like, man, that's going to suck. And she was it blew my mind.
Yeah. And I didn't mean, I bring up that movie to
bravo to him for doing that though. Like, absolutely. Bradley Cooper's got like some cojones with it, you know?
And bringing that conversation to, you know, a major studio film like A Star Is Born, it huge. Really makes it even more impactful. And, but you know, when you kind of go through programs like NA or AA, you know, you always have to say, hello, my name is so-and-so.
Right.
I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic. And I think that it is one of the most brutally hardest things to do to stand up and say that. But it's kind of like that stepping stone to, all right, this was really hard to do, but I'm really glad that I did that, because, you know, now my life is, you know, redirecting into a more positive atmosphere. You know, being a, you know, addict yourself, do you ever think that, you know, kind of taking those first steps to admit that you have a problem, like, how important is that?
Well, there's a reason it's the first step, because none of the other steps will follow. You have to admit that you have a problem, and addiction can be anything. It can be, there's so many variations of addiction. The addictive personality seems to be almost innate in a lot of people, and you can find whatever you like. So the trick is moderation, and addiction doesn't play that way. Addiction plays, I want it all, I want it now, I need, want. And if you don't accept that and acknowledge it and see it, then you're never going to make it to the second steps. You know, like, admitting you have a problem is how you're going to identify the problem and move beyond it. You know, it can be whatever. People have vices, and that's just the way humans seem to work. Alcohol, sex, drugs, shopping, eating, whatever, you know. It's just, it seems to be our nature, for whatever reasons. And I've been doing a lot of research on nature, human nature, if you will, and how addiction will fit into your personality, you know, and stuff like that. But I'm sorry, I'm getting sidetracked. You have to absolutely admit that you have a problem, or nothing else is going to happen for you.
Yeah, and I think that being honest, especially someone that even suffered from really heavy depression bordering on thoughts of suicide, to have those conversations and to say, hey, this is what I've been dealing with, it is some of the hardest conversations that you're ever going to have. But it's also some of the freeing most conversations that you're ever going to have, because I look back at those moments and those the seasons of my life, and those conversations, while in the moment they're really hard, it's, I wouldn't change those things for anything, because it's made me who I am today.
Those are, that's, that was your moment, you know, and some of the things that I do to help other addicts, you know, like, we all come to our truths at our own time.
Absolutely.
You know, and we'll all find our truths, be it whatever. And the hardest truth you're ever going to face is the one that's staring you right in your face, you know. And oftentimes that's your doing, you know. When it comes to other things in our life, you know, like losing people we love, or losing a job, or your car breaking down, whatever, we can deal with those things, you know. But the hardest one you're ever going to deal with is that battle inside your mind, because that's where addiction lies, you know. Sure, you can get addicted to pain pills because you were in an accident, but that's a small demographic compared to the vast majority of addicts, you know, and what that entails. You know, most people hide in addiction because they don't want to face reality or face their own truth. And the truth is that they're addicted.
Absolutely. All right. So if you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, you guys can reach out to us on any of our social media if you guys need to communicate and just be honest and open with anybody. This is the reason we push the content that we do, is so that you guys can know that there is a better way. But you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope, where you guys can find even more resources, including the Suicide Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255, or you guys can even text anonymously to 741-741. We have links to get connected with counselors and more on that website as well. You guys can click the links in the descriptions below, where you guys can check out The Cabin. It's now streaming on Amazon and other multiple platforms. You guys can even buy a physical copy yourself. Jason's going to be back in a couple of weeks. We're going to be talking about his comic Necroman.
Necroman.
But where can people find you online until then?
You can find me at, well, the Necroman Facebook group. Necroman, I think it's comic. Necroman. Just look up Necroman. You'll find me. Or The Art of Jason. So I'm both those places. I recently just bought, I guess it would be lease, my name on the internet, jasonso.com. So that'll be coming. My goal is to have, and what I want to do for my birthday, which is this Friday, is have a website for myself. That'll be my birthday gift to myself, you know. Like,
it's a good birthday gift to give yourself.
It's absolutely going to be a birthday gift to give to myself. I, you know what? I want a freaking website for my birthday, and I want to sell my art and stuff like that through it. So it's happy birthday to me.
Right, and you guys can find us everywhere at Victims and Villains. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you guys listen to podcasts. If you guys like what we stand for, consider supporting the show on either Etsy, Patreon, or PayPal, where for as little as $2 a month, you guys can dictate the content that we have and help us get mental health resources into more schools and conventions. But till next time, remember to keep talking nerd, talking hope, speaking nothing else, and always bring a weapon.